Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. When I first got my farm out here in the country 6-7 years ago now, I had this little sign made, and it's a couplet from the poet and satirist Juvenal, and it says, "You ask me what I get out of my country place, the profit, gross, and net is never having to see your face." And I like that. Part of the reason we moved out of the country was to have a quieter life, more introverted, philosophical, studious life. And it's been all that and so much more. But it's also given me, paradoxically, a better connection to nature, which the Stoics talk about, and to other people and to humanity. There's something about working the land, interacting with nature, raising animals, just watching the sun rise and set on the same little tank we have behind our house that gives you a connection to generations and generations and generations of people who've lived a lifestyle in that specific land. The farmers who owned it before us, or the ranchers who owned it before us, the Native Americans who traveled these plains before them, and the animals who lived here before, you know, Homo sapiens made it to America. There's just a sort of a profound connection. And as it happens, you know, the Stoics were often farmers, certainly outdoors. As I talk about in today's interview, Marcus Aurelius, some of his most beautiful passages are about nature. Cato the Elder, that would be Cato the Younger's great-great-grandfather, his essay on agriculture is one of the oldest documents that we have in the Latin language. And it's all about how to be not just a farmer, but a profitable, successful farmer. And it's a fascinating document. We've done a bunch of Daily Stoic emails about it over the years. So anyways, when this new book came out, this book, How to Be a Farmer, An Ancient Guide to Life on the Land, by the Princeton University Press, whose series I have raved about. I carry How to Be a Leader here in the Painted Porch Bookstore, their translation of Horace, How to Be Content, their Seneca and Epictetus series on anger and freedom and death. We carry all these books because we love them. And if you haven't read them, you should. You can check them out at thepaintedporch.com. I'll link them in the show notes. But this new one, I was really excited, not just to read, but to interview the author. M.D. Usher is a professor of classical languages and literature at the University of Vermont, but he also happens to be a farmer. And they own and operate the Works and Days Farm, which is itself a little classical allusion you may or may not have got. They raise lamb and chickens, and they even make maple syrup there in Vermont. And I wanted to have a conversation about farming, about nature. Remember, the Stoics talk about living in accordance with nature. And I felt like there was no one better to have this conversation with than Professor Usher. So I was very excited to have this. And I am recording this the day after Thanksgiving, in between 2 days of deer hunting. First day, not so successful. I'm hoping tomorrow will be a little bit more successful. Hoping to get a nice buck to get us through a good chunk of the year. And then I always like to have the deer processed and give out as much as I can to friends and family. You might not be pro hunting, but I do. And I did write an essay about this that we'll link in the notes as well, about the sort of Stoic connection to hunting, why I think everyone should at least do it once. And if you're getting angry about this, I totally understand, but read the essay first. I think you'll like it. And read this new book, How to Be a Farmer, An Ancient Guide to Life on the Land. There's a wonderful little chunk in here from Musonius Rufus. There's stuff in here from Cato the Elder and a bunch of other fellow travelers along with the Stoics. And I really enjoyed this conversation with Professor Usher, and I think you will too. I loved the book. I live on 40 acres outside of Austin, Texas, so I'm always interested in what the ancients have to say about country life. I thought I'd start us in the most controversial place we could possibly start with, which is reading about Cato the Elder. He is this sort of fascinating, he writes one of the first essays on agriculture, one of the earliest things we have surviving in the Latin language, books that is, seems to be this sort of frugal, efficient, down-to-earth guy. And then you're reading about him, and Plutarch tells us about his attitude towards his slaves, which I found that to be striking, to say the least, basically that he would sort of wear them out, grind them down into dust, and then sell them to get rid of them. Even, and Plutarch, who didn't seem to have much in the way of a problem with slavery, even he found this to be reprehensible. I thought we'd riff on that for a minute.
Yeah, well, you're right about that. When they're worn out, you throw them away. And in fact, the kind of terminology he uses to talk about slaves is similar to the terminology that Columella uses when he talks about donkeys in the book. So they're tools, right? They're a useful tool on the farm. But no, it is reprehensible, and it's sort of a white noise running in the background of all these texts, because Roman farming was a slave industry, really at all periods. However, if I can put in a quick however, you do see people decrying the practice. I mean, not only do you see bona fide Stoics decrying slavery as an institution, like Seneca, his famous letter of, they're servi, but he says immo homines, they're men too, people too. But you find people like Pliny the Elder talking about these latifundia that were run by slaves, and saying that, they're the ruin of the Republic, that the ruin of the empire that we now live under. So, there are voices that were of discontent to the institution, but, there was no, there was Spartacus, but there was nobody to say definitively, we need to get rid of this. But
it struck me as an analogous to the founding of America. You sort of have these two agrarian societies that are deeply philosophical, and you have people sort of questioning the institution. And then, Washington, just like Cato, sort of famously gets down and works in the field, so he knows how backbreaking the labor is. They all have this sense that, or often have this sense that there is something reprehensible about it. And they would look at the people who were particularly cruel, and they would see that as a moral evil. And yet sort of all, for 2,000 years, essentially leave the institution as it was.
Well, thank goodness that the ancients had one up on us in that regard, and that slavery was never a racial institution. It was never a racial issue at all in antiquity. It was a residual of war. And so, you know, you and I, Ryan, could find ourselves as slaves, you know, just by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Polybius, you know, was a slave, and he worked for the Scipios and wrote a great, you know, piece of Roman history in Greek. So
it was conquest-based.
It was conquest-based, but it was also universal. It wasn't just the Romans. I mean, I think slavery or slavers might be like the second oldest profession, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
I mean, it's been around since the dawn of, you know, Mesopotamia and before. So,
Yeah, you look at the Spartans, right? And it's this sort of fascinating warrior culture, and it only exists because it sits atop a system of exploitation and plunder, effectively.
Right. And they had of course, they had a whole institutionalized form of slavery of their own.
It
wasn't chattel slavery, but the helots that basically provided them, fed the war engine of Sparta. Yeah.
All right. Well, I thought it was fascinating because you have these people, and actually I've talked about this before, but there's this fascinating letter that Jefferson writes about sort of comparing American slavery to Roman slavery. And he says, you know, where is our Epictetus? Where is our Terence? You know, his rationalization was like that the Romans, they had like better slaves because he was sort of trying to rationalize the inferiority of African slaves to justify the horrendous cruelty of chattel slavery. It did feel like the Romans were more of two minds about the slavery than you know, 2,000 years later the Americans were, that the Americans had sort of deluded themselves a little bit more about it. And maybe this goes into the New World and the diseases, and they seem to have made a more biological argument for it, which obviously does not hold up well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's something that you can't shake, you can't deny. But you know, thankfully, we've outgrown it. Now we have woofers.
Yes, yes. For people who don't know what that is, it's a magical way that anyone who owns a farm or property can get free labor by accepting volunteers on your farm, which is actually how I got into it. My wife and I were thinking about doing it, and she said, you know what, before we do something like this, I'm going to actually go work on a farm. And she ended up working on a farm that's now owned, that is now our neighbor out here.
That's great. Wow. That was a smart move, and I'm glad it worked out.
Well, let's talk about something less negative than slavery. Let's talk about the philosophical magic of composting. That was one of my favorite chapters in the book.
Good. Thank you. I like that too. It was fun to do. It was fun to think of it in those terms. So you're referring to the passage of Lucretius from the De Rerum Natura. I think it's book two. No, it's book one. I can't even remember. Early on in the De Rerum Natura, where he uses the example of regenerative cycles of nature to illustrate the point that the philosophical point of atomism and Epicureanism in particular, that nothing comes from nothing or returns to nothing. So the idea is that you've got just a whole big bunch of energy or stuff out there, if you want to look at it that way, with atoms, small little bits of stuff, but that nothing's lost or nothing's gained in organic transfer in this universe that we live in. So, you know, Lucretius uses that argument, and he looks to farming in particular and to, you know, the soils, and that, you know, things are just broken down into their constituent parts and become something new, just like you and I will be broken down into our constituent parts and be pushing up daisies later. That's essentially the argument. And it just dawned on me, like, this is a philosophy of compost. It's a, you know, it's a closed loop, dynamic, but closed loop regenerative system that really represents what the biosphere is all about. And it's remarkable that I find remarkable that, you know, Epicureanism, atomism in general, kind of saw that, even if they were wrong, that, you know, everything was reducible to substance as opposed to energy. It's a keen insight, I think, on their part. I think they trumped the Stoics on that, in my view.
No, it's pretty incredible that, yeah, we're talking about this slave society that's so backwards in so many ways, and without basically any scientific tools whatsoever, they're also writing poems about how the universe is made up of atoms, and they get something so right, even though they weren't totally correct about it, but they were largely right, you know, thousands of years before we had any real way of proving it one way or another.
Right. There's two ways to look at that. I mean, I find people look at it two different ways. Some people will say, like, wow, they must have, you know, had some sort of secret insight or knowledge, you know, to have them think that way. But I look at it more pragmatically. The book I published just before this one for Cambridge was called Plato's Pigs and Other Ruminations. And essentially what it is the backstory of sustainability and complexity science in ancient thinking, and not just philosophy, but also, like, you know, religious systems, how they are sort of systems oriented. But so the power of analogy, of thinking analogically, I mean, that just does not go away. I mean, analogies are not perfect, but if you have an analogic mind and you think that way and you cultivate, you know, analogies, you can stumble upon something that is accurate, because everything is, it's about a relationship and a ratio. And if everything is connected, you're bound to kind of stumble on something that's close to the truth. You know?
So. Well, and that goes to the analogy you made, which is that the same thing that happens to our plants and food and a tree that falls in the woods is also what will happen to us. And so there's this sort of profound philosophical implication for coming to this idea of regeneration.
Right. And it's a source of comfort for the Epicureans that, you know, you don't have to fear death because, you know, nothing bad's going to happen afterwards. And it also is a positive value that, you know, you should enjoy life, you know, while you have it. Gather your rosebuds while you may. Do so temperately, right? Not, you know, it's not a pleasure-seeking hedonist viewpoint that, you know, we commonly associate with Epicureanism, but it's something that we can just enjoy our friends, enjoy the life and time we have, and we must.
Has living out in nature and raising livestock particularly, has it changed your relationship with death? I have found, I think that was the thing that surprised me most, just like, even if you take really good care of everything, even if you're on top of it. I mean, I had to kill a possum like 3 days ago that was, you know, in my chicken coop in the middle of tearing some of my pet chickens to shreds. And just the sort of the ordinariness of life and death in the sort of agricultural life. It's just so, I mean, obviously it would have been commonplace in the ancient world as well, but it's, I think, so in such stark contrast to our antiseptic lives in, let's say, the city, that I think it does force you to chew on some of this stuff a bit.
Absolutely. And the only way you're going to get it in the modern world is if you, like, you choose it. I mean, because we are so technologically disconnected from nature and those processes. And it's almost like an ideological decision you got to make, that I'm going to experience this because I know that this is part of what it means to be a human being. And I need this. You know, whether you become a farmer and it becomes your profession, that's another matter. But, you know, there's a day when everybody knew how to kill a chicken to eat it if you were going to eat it.
Sure.
And a killing a possum, you know, over a chicken wouldn't bother. You wouldn't think twice about it. Of course you would do that. You know, once upon a time, people were pragmatic and they lived much more, you know, closely to, again, the whole life cycle, life and death, both. So to answer the front part of your question is that, doing this farming, we raise sheep. You definitely see it all the time. The moment when a lamb and a ewe, a mother ewe, is most susceptible to death is at that moment of birth, which is, like, hugely paradoxical, right?
Sure.
That's when they're both in
talk about regeneration.
Exactly. So, but it's also the most beautiful moment, right? You know. That ewe's got the genetic memory to, we call it instinct, knows how to lick that lamb off. The lamb knows how to respond and find the udder. It's like you look at it and it's like a miracle, but it could all go south in like, you know, 5 minutes, right? Depending on, you know, whatever. And then sometimes things happen where, you know, mothers reject their young. I mean, that's not like a freak thing of nature. That happens a lot.
Right.
And I've always thought like, is that just bad genetics? Is it just a bad mother? And do we have to call that you because, you know, she just doesn't have that instinct well enough to you know, to warrant keeping her. And I've come around to the view that actually, I think they know what they're capable of. I think that what happens when a mother rejects a baby, an offspring, is that she knows what her carrying capacity is. Like she's kind of aware, like, I don't think I've got enough milk for that. Or I'm like super exhausted after that particularly difficult birth.
Yeah.
And it's like it's a calculation that she's making. So anyway, when you're involved in farming, how would I have learned that? That's just anecdotal. That's not a scientific, you know, statement that I just made. But it's something. How else would you come to it? And how else could you, you know, reorient your way of thinking about these things unless you were ensconced in it?
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
And then to go to the point about Cato and his relationship with the slaves, you then sort of get this weird insight into, like, there's this financial component, right? You're like, how much am I going to spend, like, whether it's on veterinary care or time and energy, right? Like your decision of, like, should we cull this lamb because it's not a good mother? There's this sort of weird element where you're forced to make these decisions that are sort of matters of life and death in some cases, outside of, I don't know, the army or the upper echelons of politics, people are just not ordinarily in a position to make. You know, we've deferred that authority elsewhere, and suddenly you're the one that decides, hey, is it worth, you know, I bought some cows when we bought our place that came with some cows that the person had who had the property before us had run. And, you know, they sort of told us they were much younger than they actually were. And, it turns out, you know, they're very, very old. And then you got to make a decision. Hey, are you going to spend, are you going to call a vet out to put this very old sick cow down? Are you going to let it starve to death? Or am I going to have to go out there and dispatch this animal who's eaten out of my hand you know, personally. And suddenly, again, life and death isn't this abstract thing or this thing that happens to you and you feel sad about it, but it's a thing that you're an active participant in. And that's a whole other element.
Totally true. It sounds like you already know how to be a farmer. These are some of the things that really distinguish, you know, the hobbyist from somebody who really does it and must do it. And there's a whole bunch of, you know about the Stoics. There's a whole bunch of necessity involved in farming, you know, like,
yes,
like this massive, you know, oppressive necessity that you have to face and you have to do. But the notion of profit, and you're right, that as perverse as it is to our way of thinking today and unacceptable as it is, you know, because Cato's looking at his slaves as tools and as, you know, instrumenta is what he calls them. Of course they're dispensable, you know, like any tool, once it's worn out, you throw it away. Now that's awful way to think about it.
Because they're, yes, human beings.
But, the thing about profit that you mentioned is also something people fail to see. And actually, frankly, I don't engage with myself to the same degree that a real farmer will have to, because,
sure,
I have a day job, right?
Right?
I write books and I teach classes. I'm really happy for that day job, but we're bigger than just a hobby farm. So, you know, it doesn't, but the word for profit in Latin, you may know this, is fructus, which means fruit. So for a farm to be fruitful, fructuosus, means for it to be profitable. And the ancients were really down on bad farming. I mean, the modern Italians are already kind of food chauvinists and kind of like, you know, landscape chauvinists in some ways. Like, they're very, very regional, particular about stuff. And that's a compliment, by the way, not a put down for Italians.
Sure.
The Romans were the same thing. They looked at property that was unused and they thought, this is a waste. You know, in fact, That's what they called it, a wasteland. And so we have that kind of that view on the part of the Romans that, you know, land is meant to be managed and used, not exploited, but used sort of in a cooperative way to produce fructus, which is food and profit.
No, to go to one other point about this life and death that I thought was interesting is, so it's deer season here in Texas. And so my sister was visiting for Thanksgiving and I went yesterday. I didn't see anything. I'm going to go probably tomorrow. And I said, hey, you should come with me. Just come sit in the deer stand. We'll spend a couple hours together and maybe we'll get a deer. And she goes, I don't want to. I don't want to see, like, I don't want to touch a dead animal, is basically what she said. And I was like, you know, I just watched you spend 3 hours holding a dead turkey all day, you know, cooking it and prepping it as if it was very different than what I'm about to go do out in the pasture. And in fact, you know, this deer, which roams freely and wildly on the property because they don't have high fence, is probably, and certainly the way I'm dispatching it, is far more humane and natural and timeless than this factory farmed turkey that we bought, even though, you know, we tried to buy something, you know, that checks the various boxes. And so it is interesting how it's not that we think we're above it. We just don't want to know about it, right? We just sort of detach ourselves from it and then act as if that sort of removes our culpability, but we're fine to have other people do it in our names.
This woman named Alexis Shotwell wrote a book called Against Purity, came out a couple of years ago, and I use it in the other book I just mentioned to you, Plato's Pigs, where she basically says, yeah, that's like the Western European, white Western European American problem, is that we think we can live a life free of, you know, toxins and a completely, you know, antisepticized life. You kind of can with the technologies that we have, but it's a false life. It's a false consciousness, and it's not going to get you anywhere. In fact, it's going to be harmful in the end, because you get, you know, defamiliarized from what makes us human. I mean, we're animal, people are animals too. What you're describing is interesting. You know, I think that I've always thought this, but I'm thinking about it more recently, that, you know, the ancients were you know, they were earthier than we are. They were closer to both the perils and prospects of their environments in pretty much every respect. I mean, you know, they saw that, saw death. They were agents of death. They were closer to all these things, and they had I think it yields a sensitivity in a strange way to describe it. A sensitivity once you know what that is, like having to kill an animal or dealing with death on the farm, which happens all the time, you actually don't become desensitized to it. You just kind of you realize it for what it is, and it gives you kind of an outlook that I would just describe as the ability to react sensibly and earnestly, carefully. I don't know what the right word is.
No, I agree. When you feel it, it's like you're connecting with something that was always there. Like I suppose it's a very sort of primal or essential part of who we are. So like when you go hunting, let's say, or you have to dispatch an animal on the farm or whatever, there is this sort of unfamiliarity, this sort of, you know, the nerves of it or whatever. And then you also, I think as it goes on though, you're like, not that I'm meant to do this, but you're like, I'm more familiar with this than perhaps I would have imagined I would be.
Well, there are people who say like once a hunter gatherer, always a hunter gatherer. I mean, we just sort of sublimate that in other ways. So is it better to then be just a hunter gatherer? Probably, you know, at least to know how to do it.
Yes.
And so that's really interesting. But anyway,
well, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's, you know, we got into farming for ideological reasons. I mean, it wasn't just we weren't born into it. My wife's from Manchester, England. She's a city girl. I didn't grow up with that, but we were very intentional, like, you know, in a Peruvian kind of way, deliberate about wanting to make this connection that we've been talking about for the past 10 minutes here. And that has been the best takeaway from farming. I mean, you know, it's been developmental for me as a person. I think I'm probably a better person for it. I'm certainly more patient than I ever used to be in my life, because you can't make a donkey go anywhere that doesn't want to go, or even a cow or sheep. Sheep will go the way you don't want them to go. So, you know, you can't yell at them. You know, you can't beat them with a stick. None of that works. And you just have to learn to kind of cooperate with them. So this idea of man dominating nature, I think that's kind of a myth too. You've got to cooperate with nature. Otherwise you get nothing out of it.
Well, nature is sort of the logos. Nature is the rhythm, and you're connecting to it and going along with it. And maybe you can direct it a little bit one way or another, but it is a reminder of who's in charge.
It's true. That's a good way to put it. Tracking is, we just talked about hunter-gatherers. Tracking is a great example of that. You have to kind of, when you, like the Kalahari Bushmen or whatever, tracking an animal, you have to cooperate with all the signs that you're seeing and put them all together. And you have to be patient. And this persistence tracking can take, you know, days before you get your quarry. So that is character building.
Well, I want to talk about donkeys in a second, but I think when people hear that you're operating this farm, I imagine one of the reactions is that that's somehow very different or unusual for a philosopher to do, which is, I think, an interesting, I don't want to say indictment, but it kind of is an interesting indictment, or at least statement, about where philosophy has gone. Because in the ancient world, they would have been seen as like this. One of my favorite chapters in the book, and I think it's one of the only ones that actually is directly from a Stoic, you have Musonius Rufus saying that, and for people listening, Musonius Rufus is Epictetus's philosophy teacher. Musonius Rufus basically says, there is no better profession for a philosopher than a farmer. Specifically, I think talks about shepherds as being even down further in the types of farmers. But talk to me about the connection between philosophy and farming.
Okay. Let me just say about Musonius, the two main things he says that farming is good for is that even though it involves physical work, it involves physical work, it's not the kind of work that will distract you from ruminating and thinking about all the things you need to think about to become a better person. It provides that kind of time for self-reflection and cultivating the mind. Again, paradoxically, you work with your body, but that work is kind of frees you to work with it, to kind of cultivate the mind. And the other thing he says that's good about it is that you're kind of on the spot, and you're also under somebody's watchful eye. In other words, usually farming is somehow a cooperative venture. It involves other people. And in particular, he talks about the teacher and the student working out in the fields together. Well, if you get pissed off, or you show impatience, or you show lack of character, or if you show laziness or intolerance of somebody else's faults, well, it's on full display. People are going to see it. So it kind of holds you accountable in a way. And I see this with my wife. I mean, she's a better person than I am. She's got the patience of Job, and she has that just by nature, that kind of cooperative approach to everything. I'm more of a, let's just get this over with and fix it and do it and go on to the next thing, whatever it is. And, I've learned really from her how awful, some of my attitudes are. And where does it come out? It doesn't really come out in my human relationships. It comes out in interacting with the animals when you get like impatient or you.
Because they can feel the energy, right? They react to the energy and the actions you're taking. And I've driven cows through a fence because I wasn't taking my time. I got frustrated. And now it's like, now I got to spend 6 hours fixing this fence.
All right. So yeah. That's one thing. The other thing that, and it's not even a Greco-Roman idea per se, though it does have some resonance with Stoicism, that I get out of farming is this notion of like dharmic detachment. So in other words, you do your, like in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Arjuna doesn't, he's terrified. He's repulsed by the notion that he has to kill his cousins on the battlefield. And then Krishna comes down and tells him, and he gives us a long discourse about you need to do what your duty is in life, whatever that is. For him, it's a warrior. Arjuna is a warrior. And so you need to fulfill that duty in life, but you need to act with detachment. So in other words, you need to be kind of emotionally detached from the activity that you do. Or maybe psychologically detached. Doesn't mean you're going to be a robot or anything like that, but you have to actively cultivate this notion of being detached from the results of action. Do it with all your might. Farming teaches you that like nothing else, because the outcomes are so unpredictable. Whether you're a crop farmer, depends on the weather, or you're an animal farmer, also depends on the weather, but it depends on so many different things. I mean, sheep 101 is like whatever can go wrong will go wrong. And a sheep wants to die. That's the first given. The sheep will want to die. I mean, so you're trying to prevent that. You do everything you can, but then still you come up short. So to be able to cope with that, you have to, I found that you just have to have this, you do everything you can. You do it well. You do it to the best of your ability. You make sure you close that gate. You make sure you're thinking in the future, you're planning properly, you're not lazy, you're not forgetting, but you're not putting something off, procrastinating. But at the same time, you still just can't think that it's a guarantee that it's going to come out the way you want it to, because it won't.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Yeah, I think in the Gita, it says like you're entitled to the labor, but not the fruits of the labor, to go back to the thing you were saying earlier. And so, you know, at the core of Stoicism is this dichotomy of control. What's up to you? What's not up to you? You control if you do everything right, but you don't control if it rains. You don't control if they come down with this or that. You don't control if a coyote comes or a mountain lion comes, or, you know, you don't control what your neighbors do. You know, that for me, the country life thing, the animals I'm okay with. It's the, you know, it's the other people who choose to live out in the country that tend to test my patience for the most part.
Yeah, but I live in the People's Republic of Vermont.
You probably have it too. I mean, like, you know, I say this, the wonderful part about being in the country is you can do whatever you want. The worst part about living in the country is that everyone else can do whatever they want. And for some people, that means collecting, you know, broken down cars in their front yard, or burning their trash, or shooting an AR-15 off in the morning. And, you know, that just goes with the territory, and all you can do is accept it and try not to loathe the people that you live next to.
Right. Well, Hesiod has that passage in there about good neighbors. You know, good fencers make good neighbors, but you have to also cultivate that relationship as best you can.
Have you found that farming has made you a better philosopher and classicist, or is it challenge? Is it fought for the same resources?
Well, it certainly has changed the tack I'm taking in my thinking and research and writing. So when I wrote that book, Plato's Pigs, that was the moment where I kind of put all the eggs in one basket. Up to that time, we've been farming for about 20 years. Up to that time, I had kind of lived a double life, right? I was classicist by day and farmer at home, and never really thought about integrating, you know, them philosophically speaking, or in terms of, like, you know, worldview. And I mean, I had thought about it, but I never thought about doing it professionally, like writing about it and being public about it. But with that book, I did merge the two. So I used my training and my aptitudes in classics and my experience in farming to come up, you know, with basically an argument that, you know, the West is not, I mean, basically the canonical literature of classics has a lot to say that speaks to us in contemporary terms about sustainability and about holistic, you know, interconnections of things in nature and how we need to be a part of that. And so in that way, yeah, I think it has made me a better classicist, because I think I'm more useful now. You know? I mean, I feel like, you know, what I say and what I'm thinking and feeling about, you know, what I'm reading in these ancient texts matters, because it's translatable. I mean, not, you know what I mean by that, you know,
sure,
translatable into life choices, even into, you know, something as crazy as policy making, you know? So the book I'm writing now is kind of about that. And you'll like the title. It's called Secundum Naturam, and it's, you know, according to nature. And the overarching argument of the book is that it's kind of like that Lucretius passage that, you know, if nature works this way, you know, as a closed loop dynamic system, then the economy should work that way too, right? And so should the decisions that we make that, you know, within that, you know, within the economy. So how are we gonna power the grid? Well, solar energy is makes sense. So does wind energy, because it involves that same principle that exists in nature of a closed loop dynamic system. So there's analogical thinking that can take you a long way, because, you know, we have the technology to actually implement these things. Do we have the will? No, probably not. And do we have the kind of economy that can tolerate it? No, not yet, but we need it. So anyway.
But don't you think, I've got to imagine that you have a set of skills and a certain self-sufficiency that's probably anomalous amongst your philosophical peers, right? That again, in the ancient world, would have been the exact opposite. You know, like Socrates is a soldier. Musonius Rufus is a political advisor and does all these other things. It is interesting how, as philosophy has become more and more specialized, I do feel like the philosopher, man or woman, has become more of an academic figure than a sort of a real world person who is, in, unlike you, or sort of contrasting with you, not down in the earth, touching real things, doing real things in the real world.
That's true. I mean, one of your guys, when I say your guys, was a Stoic sage, Cleanthes, used to be a gardener.
Yeah, he was a water carrier.
Exactly, and a sometime boxer. You know, so they did have life experience. You're probably familiar with Pierre Hadot. Philosophy as a Way of Life. I read that when it first came out in English translation, and I'm rereading it now. Some of it in French
because one of my all-time favorite books.
Okay, well, it should be because it was revolutionary, and I read it back then, but now I'm rediscovering it. I just love that because the argument that all ancient philosophy, even from the elites like Plato and Aristotle, was all about how to live well, how to live a full, truthful, life that is in sync with the way the world really is. No holds barred, whatever it takes to reach that point. That's what ancient philosophy was all about. Yes, there are these petty arguments within it, whatever, but ultimately that was the thrust of it. And so you're right. The ancients had it. It was a lifestyle, a way of life, and not just something taught in universities. Right?
Well, it's like they all had, you said you have a day job. It's like, the Stoics all had day jobs, and then philosophy was the secondary practice, right? Even in Meditations, Marcus Aurelius talks about how philosophy basically can't be your stepmother. Philosophy has to be your real mother, and then you have this other thing that you do. But I saw it as a balancing act. You have your real world experience where you're interacting with real people, and you're being challenged as a merchant or a soldier or a whatever. And then you also have your philosophical practice, and the two are informing each other, just as you found that, oh, hey, my understanding of a farm and philosophy now creates real insights that can inform, policymakers and, consumers and fellow farmers, because either one of those independently would not have been as fruitful.
Right. That's why I like the whole generation of like the people, the World War One, poets and a lot of the people who served, in either World War One or World War Two, that were, persons of letters, people yes. who were literary or philosophically inclined.
The Brits especially.
Who?
The Brits especially. Yes, it's like a whole generation of poets and writers.
Exactly. And then there's this, it gives an authenticity to their work for me because of that life experience. I mean, it wasn't farming, but it was, it was a life or death kind of experience and it changed them and, sometimes harmed them. But it was, there's something that gives that authenticity to me. I mean, Wittgenstein wrote the Tractatus while he was like in the trenches of World War One, for instance. Even like go back a couple of generations, René Descartes wrote, the Discourse on Method when he was like serving as a mercenary in the Dutch army. And he was like locked himself in a room for some quiet time and to think about what's really important. And he writes the Discourse on Method.
So I think Lawrence was talking about how to translate the Odyssey or the Iliad, you have to have done a variety of things to be able to speak to Odysseus's experience. Yeah, the philosopher adventurer is an archetype that doesn't really exist as much anymore these days.
Yeah, so you get Lawrence of Arabia quoting Themistius, when he's on trial, and he carries Apuleius's golden ass in his saddlebag when he's out there, you know, fomenting the Arab revolt. You know, anyway, that's a different generation, and it had its own problems, no doubt about it. But there is something about the vita contemplativa and the vita activa meshing that is really important, you know, now more than ever, because we're losing it.
And I don't remember the Latin expression, but also the sort of sound body sound mind in a strong body. The idea of like active body, active mind is also, I think, something that you can lose if you just sit behind a desk all day.
True. Mens sana in corpore sano. That's you do. And what do we do? We do sit behind a desk all day. What are we doing now?
Well, so talk to me about living with accordance of nature, living in accordance with nature, because I feel like of all the Stoic phrases that I hear people ask about the most, and that I probably, if I'm answering it, feel like I'm on the shakiest ground. This is one of those things that is repeated incessantly amongst the philosophers, and it's like no one bothers to actually define what it is. Maybe it's just one of those things that gets lost, but what does it actually mean?
All right. Well, I'll go out on shaky ground here too, on a limb. It means many things. Even in antiquity, it meant many things because nature is a slippery concept. You know, it can mean so many different things, and it's not a fixed entity. I'll just give a couple of examples. So that we talked about Lucretius before. So living according to nature for an Epicurean means that your ethics proceed from your physics. So in other words, the ethical system that you have is based on an understanding of how the world is strung together and how it works physically, scientifically, we would say. That's what the Epicureans meant by living according to nature. The Stoics had a different cosmology and a different picture of how the universe was strung together, but they still had that same idea that your ethics should proceed from your physics. They fudged it a little bit. I think they kind of adjusted their physics to fit their ethics, but they use this image, you're probably familiar with it, of the egg. So like, you know, the Stoic philosophical system is like an egg. So you've got the outer shell is logos, is like logic, but logic not just like formal logic, but discourse as well, like just speaking. So the arts of logos are the shell. The ethics is the white part, the albumen, and then the physics are the yolk. So what does it mean to live according to nature for a Stoic? I have an idea. I'm going to spring it on you now. So yeah, the concept of oikeosis in Stoicism.
Our affinity for each other.
Affinity for each other, but I'm going to say it. I'm going to be even more general than that. Our affinity or our relationships to our environments, because Stoics use this term, and many of the examples that they give come from the animal kingdom. So an example is, animals know what they're supposed to do by instinct. We say by instinct, and they don't veer from that. I mean, they're pretty consistent. They have this instinctual urge to do the right thing according to their nature. We call it, in modern scientific terms, it's called proprioception. They're aware of what they're doing bodily, physically, in the environment that they occupy, whatever that is. Could be an amoeba, could be a deer. Humans, the Stoics said, we have a problem, and the problem is reason. Now, the problem is also a tool, but the fact that we have the noodle means that we can deceive ourselves, or we can make, we have will, we have volition, we can choose the wrong course of action. So we have the capability of not living according to nature, and so therefore we need to fix it. And they had the whole solution of, getting back to nature meant getting back to human nature, where virtue was everything and rationality was the access point for that thing. So this notion, I actually kind of think it's like the first environmental philosophy, where they argue that human beings and animal, human beings like animals need to stay within the bounds and the confines of what they were created for lack of a better word, what they are by nature. And so secundum naturam, in that way of thinking, is knowing your limits and knowing your bounds and knowing your proper reactions and actions and how all those fit together with that environment. So I don't know if that's one answer to that. So what's a modern application? Here's what I think about that. You've heard of the concept of like biomimicry, right? Where you invent Velcro from the way seed pods stick on the, whatever that's called. I don't know the technical terminology, but Velcro was invented that way. And they invent all sorts of gadgets, based on how things work in nature, because I think, well, nature's got a good design. We can mimic that.
Flight, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of like a form of biomimicry. So as the world works, so should we model, to the degree that we can, the way human societies work or the way our interactions with others work on those sorts of relationships.
I have been a little curious though, then how does how does living in accordance with nature bump into what they call the naturalistic fallacy? Like just because it's natural doesn't mean that it's right. Or just because it happens in nature doesn't mean that it's right.
Right. No, that's true. And I think the Stoic answer to that would be that we have, human beings have a soul for one thing. They believe that, and we have rationality, which is a component of that soul. So we have a dimension of experience. We also have recursive thought and consciousness. So our interaction would be different because than other species in nature for that reason. And so that we would have to define what was quote unquote natural for us, factoring in those elements as well. I think that would be what the Stoics would say about that. But it's not so simplistic as just because it exists in nature, go out and do likewise.
Sure.
I don't think that's what they're suggesting and recommending. And that's not what I'm thinking and suggesting and recommending too. There's something also qualitatively different about a human being. Animals don't write books about us. We write books about them. There's something to that. But that's the mystery of consciousness is something we're not going to solve that here today.
No, I mean, one of the things I think loosely connected to this that I've always found the most compelling in some of the Stoic writings, particularly in Marcus Aurelius, who's supposedly this sort of dour, depressive guy. I've always loved the observations about nature, which made me think he was much more agrarian or outdoorsy than we perhaps think. He talks about the way that grain bends under its own weight, talks about the flecks of foam on a boar's mouth, the way that ripe olives fall from the tree. He clearly spent a lot of time outside looking very closely at things, being very present. And then there's a great phrase from Seneca where he says, the whole world is a temple of the gods. The idea of the farm or life or the outdoors is this sort of temple, this magical place, kind of in the way that John Muir talks about it. I feel like we don't talk about that enough, particularly with the Stoics, that they were in love with the natural world.
Yeah, that's terrific. I mean, for Marcus, I mean, he wrote the Meditations while he was in a tent, on campaign in Dacia. So he was seeing plenty of the outdoors. And you're right. I mean, and both the Greeks and the Romans, they had great affection for, their environs. Maybe you're right that we don't think about that enough from the Stoics.
Which is sort of going through like the transcendentalists, it's sort of like you go outside and you really look at what nature is, the canvas of nature. You're sort of looking at the world through the eyes of a poet or an artist. Again, the Stoics are supposed to be seen as these sort of depressive, resigned figures. But to me, that seems very at odds with the love of beauty that comes through in their philosophical writings.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. And you know, the Epicureans were that way too, because the, you know, the school of Epicurus was called, you know, the garden, because that's where they first met. And that idea of, you know, spending time together in nature, yeah, it's resonant. So
do you have donkeys?
We have donkeys.
How many have you got?
Just two. They're called Turks and Caicos, because that's where we'd rather be in Vermont, February.
I've got two donkeys also. I bought one when someone was liquidating a petting zoo, which is about the saddest Craigslist ad I've ever seen in my life. And then I bought another one from a lady on Craigslist. And they're wonderful. They're like big, dumb dogs with a stronger opinion about how things should be.
good description. Ours came to us in a similar way. They were like hand-me-downs from people who were horse people who had these animals, and they were moving to North Carolina, and they couldn't take them with them. And one of them actually was a therapy donkey. So it's like a certified trained therapy donkey. That would be Turks.
And what do you use them for? For us, they just hang out with the cows, and they keep away like coyotes and mountain lions and stuff.
Now, have you verified that they actually do that?
Well, so one day one of them came back all cut up, and the vet thinks that he got in a scrape with a mountain lion or something like that. We haven't lost anything to mountain lions, so it's hard to prove a negative, but it does seem like they keep things away.
You want to trade donkeys then? I have two. Because the reason we got the donkeys were to be guard animals for the sheep.
Yeah.
Now, because we have one pasture that's about, you know, it's in, on our property, but it's like across the dead end dirt road that we live on up in the woods. And it's a big clearing up there. And it's fenced in, but, you know, we lost some lambs, you know, 2 years in a row up there because of that, because of the distance from the house. So we thought we'd get the donkeys to solve that problem. And they think they are supercilious. They think they're better than the sheep. Yes. They don't want anything to do with them.
So that's funny.
They don't hang out with them. You know, wherever the sheep are, they intentionally go somewhere else. You know, they like to be on their own. So, you know, I think we have two donkeys that aren't really serving their purpose, but I tell you, they're my favorite animals on the farm.
They're so sweet. And, it's this weird thing, because they're very sweet and nice, but you also get this sense that it's like they're still dangerous. Do you know what I mean? Like, don't push them. It's like maybe a pit bull or something.
Right. Well, they do kick. They can kick.
Yeah. But yeah, you can't make them. It's like an egotistical person. The only way you can get them to do anything is to make them think it was their idea.
That's a good way to, that's correct. That's true. I think they will teach you the farmer's patience more than any other animal, right? Because they don't move, and they seem to have a way to like not move in a way that's even, you know, more grounded than even like a large bull or a cow.
Yes.
It's like they just won't move. You can't even push them to get them started.
I've always been like, sometimes I've told this story before, but you know, you can come across a donkey. If the donkey doesn't know that you're there, it'll just stand there for like an hour. Like, you'll not move. Like the stillness of them is something I've taken some philosophical lessons from, the just sort of like the serene comfort with themselves and the, not just the total obliviousness to time or urgency or anything but what they feel like doing is kind of marvelous to watch.
Yes, yes. Well, that's why probably Eeyore is a donkey, which may be like a depressive one.
Yes.
Somehow has come to terms with the way the world works and the way it is and accepts it.
Well, my favorite Stoicism story is related to donkeys. Again, we see the Stoics as these very dour, humorless figures, but supposedly Chrysippus dies laughing at a donkey eating figs.
Oh, that's a story I did not know. That's a great one.
Yeah, yeah. He's sitting on his front porch, and a donkey walks in and starts eating figs in his garden. And apparently Chrysippus said some joke like, does he need some wine to wash down those figs? and begins to laugh so hard at his own joke that he shortly thereafter drops dead, which is quite a way to go, I feel like.
Well, there are a lot of donkeys around. I mean, you'd have many, many opportunities to see donkeys in ancient Greece or Rome.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I'm dealing with that myself. Because so we rescued these donkeys sort of late, and the vet told us it was too late to fix the male donkey that we got. It was already like 6 or 7 years old. So we get like another donkey every 13 or so months, and you can't keep them. So we feel like we're in this, they're not worth anything, as you know. So we're in this constant mode of trying to rehome a donkey about once every 18 months. It's been both a burden, but also kind of a wonderful way to connect with people. Cause you're always like, I bet I could trick this person into becoming a donkey person. And that's that's our journey.
Too bad you're in Texas, because I can't tell you how many times we've gotten a call from somebody saying like, where did you get your donkeys from? We can't find one. We want one.
Well, cause yeah, I think people do need them. Yeah. And then, although I guess like out in the West, there's just an enormous feral donkey population.
Huh.
And Hawaii too. You can see them just walking around in some of these places. Like, I guess from the West, it's from the mines. You know, they had them in the mines, and then they just let them go, and now they're just there. And then in Hawaii, you know, people just let them go on the islands, and now they've got a wild donkey population.
Oh, huh, amazing! Anyway, yeah, I like them.
They're the best. They're the best. Let's see what else I wanted to ask you about, if there's anything else. I guess the last thing, just because it pertains to climate, and I do think it's important. Where philosophically what do the philosophers have to teach us about this sort of moment of time that we're in, where, you know, years of neglecting or abusing the climate is coming back to haunt us? We're sort of wrestling with not just our obligations, but I feel like we're also wrestling with this massive collective action problem, which is, how do you do something about it that wasn't totally your fault, but it is now the problem of our time? So what do the philosophers have to teach us? And what does Farman have to teach us as well?
Huh. Well, there is a passage in the book, as you know, from Plato. And it's not us. It's kind of an outlier passage, because it's not directly about farming. But what it is about, it's about the construction of an ideal society. And it's Socrates' first attempt to say what the ideal society would look like. And it's interesting. I kind of think of it as like he's engaging in playing Sim City, maybe, you know, tongue in cheek just a little bit. But I think he's also earnest, where, you know, he says that societies come together because of mutual need. You know, no one is self-sufficient by themselves, so we need each other. And so the idea of cooperation is at the root of city formation. And then he talks about how the people would live in this ideal city, and it would be an agrarian, rustic community, ideally, and it would be a vegetarian community. It would be a community that was self-supporting, you know, through cooperation amongst themselves. And the reason for that, it would be happy, content with what it had within its territory, within its environs, because otherwise you would be encroaching on other people's property to get things that you want, or that you think that you need or you want. So because the ideal society doesn't do that, there is no war. And because there's no war, there's no slaves. And Plato paints the picture, it sounds like, you know, Edward Hicks' Peaceable Kingdom, where people are, you know, they work by day naked out in the sun, and at night, you know, they sit by the fire, you know, and munch acorns and drink wine. And he says something to the effect, actually, let's see if I can get this close to right. He says, they will have sex with one another. They'll mate, and they'll, but they won't produce children beyond their means. He says that specifically. And he says they will ensure that they leave a life similar to the one that they've enjoyed for their progeny. So it's like got all the ingredients. Plato was such a genius, really. He understands like this systemic view of how a society works, and how it needs to think about its future as much as its present, and that it has to live within limits. So, you know, with climate change, well, if anything, that we've exceeded limits on every front. And the biosphere, though, is the ultimate limit. So, I mean, we are living within limits, but we're living as if there aren't, that isn't, there isn't that limit of the biosphere. And I think, you know, somebody like Plato has a lot to teach us about that. The other thing about Plato that you just mentioned, like how to motivate people, how to get kind of collective action, you know, his analogy or his homology between the soul and the state that the Republic is big on, right? That the tripart soul is like equivalent to the tripart state, and the cooperation amongst those, the proper cooperation amongst those three parts in both soul and state need to be in order. And that's like the definition of justice. All of that, I think, can speak to, you know, individual, maybe allegorically speak to it, but individual harmony or just living or righteous living in the world, the kind of choices that you make, things that you do, how you view things. Do I need that new television? No, you don't. And how we make collective decisions, which, you know, we're just a collection of individuals formed by mutual need, according to Plato. So we could think about that as that homology between soul and state, personal action and civic action, productively, I think. I mean, it's not one-for-one correspondence, but we have to recognize, I think, the recognition of that homology is important.
Yeah, Marcus Aurelius in Meditations talks about how what's bad for the hive is bad for the bee. I think he meant, you know, other individuals, but I also, the sense that the planet is our hive and that we owe an obligation to take care of it, and that this sort of idea of leave it as good or better than you found it is the sort of inherent obligation that we have as citizens, but also as philosophers and sort of students of wisdom and virtue. Like, yeah. you can't abuse this thing and then hand the check to your children or grandchildren, or, you know, literal or figurative. That's an inherently unvirtuous thing to do.
Right. Well, you're familiar with Heracles's Circles of Concern.
Yes.
And I think you had a guy on your program before, or he's written for you, Kai Whiting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's written he sent me a couple of years ago a really terrific article, really, on applying Heracles's Circles of Concern. He actually had this nice diagram that he drew to show how that idea, that Stoic idea, is perfectly translatable to the modern situation of resource use and allocation, how it all works. So there you go. I think the ancients do speak to that problem. They don't have the science to solve the problem, but the problem that we face is really not a scientific one.
I mean, yeah, like if your neighbor was polluting your yard, you do something about it. And I think the idea of the circles of concern is, how can you apply that same level of outrage — isn't exactly a Stoic word — but how can you apply that same level of concern to some river that you'll never see in your life, or, you know, the protection of a tree that you won't live long enough to sit in the shade of? But if you expand the circles of control, you get there pretty quickly. And that's why sort of preserving and protecting the land and the resources, it really matters. And it's a philosophical pursuit, not just some sort of social justice environmental pursuit. It's a philosophical pursuit.
Right. And if people could be convinced that you are connected to that tree on the other side of the world in a very real way, you would care about it.
Yeah.
And if enough people feel that way, then maybe something will happen. I don't know.
I hope so. I certainly hope so. We've made so much progress from the ancient world, as we've talked about. You know, whether, let's say, with the eradication of slavery, but there are certainly other things that 2,000 years from now, they're going to look back and be aghast at. And I think we have an obligation to try to tackle those things as much as we can in our own time.
Yep, indeed.
Professor, this was amazing. I loved the book. I love the Princeton University Press series. I've read like a dozen of these now. They're all awesome. But I was very excited to see this one. And it was an honor to have you on.
Thanks for having me. The next one's about the cynics, and that's coming out next fall.
Well, I'd love to talk about that one too.
Sounds good. Me too.
Hey, it's Ryan. Thank you for listening to the Daily Stoic podcast. I just wanted to say we so appreciate it. We love serving you. It's amazing to us that over 30 million people have downloaded these episodes in the couple years we've been doing it. It's an honor. Please spread the word, tell people about it. And this isn't to sell anything. I just wanted to say thank you. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery the destination for business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.